Welcome to Real Chalk, a Shrug Collective production. Mike Bledsoe here, stoked to be launching this network so that we can introduce you to amazing content providers like Ryan Fisher. We'll be posting new shows every weekday, so be on the lookout. As a thank you for listening, Thrive Market has a special offer for you. You get $60 of free organic groceries, plus free shipping, and a 30-day trial. Go to thrivemarket.com/realchalk. This is how it works. Users will get $20 off their first three orders of $49 or more, plus free shipping. No code is necessary because the discount will be applied at checkout. Many of you will be going to the store this week, so just hit up Thrive Market today. Go to thrivemarket.com/realchalk to get set up. Enjoy the show.
And howdy, kids. How we doing? This is Yaya here from the Real Chalk podcast. You guys are tuned in to the Shrug Collective, and we got a brand new episode coming at you guys. Once more, this is one of the episodes that we recorded while at Paleo FX in Austin, and we had a super awesome opportunity to sit down with a super awesome guest. I'm going to try and put super awesome in a sentence one more time somewhere. We sat down with Dr. Mike T. Nelson. He has been a fan and a part of the Barbell Shrug podcast for a long time, and now we finally got to pick his brain ourselves. Dr. Mike T. Nelson honestly has one of the longest resumes you guys will ever see, but probably one of the most known factors, or let's be honest, the one that's going to matter the most to you right now. He is the inventor of the metabolic flexibility, or the flexible dieting. So counting your macros, if it fits your macros, all that stuff. You have Dr. Mike T. Nelson to thank for that. On top of that, this guy has a PhD in exercise physiology from the University of Minnesota, a BA in natural science, a MS in biomechanics. He's an adjunct professor in human performance. He's a professional NSCA member, and so on and so on. This guy's the real deal, guys, and we had such a blast sitting with him, and I could have gone on forever. As you guys can already tell, this episode's a little bit longer. I think we went just over 90 minutes, and like I said, I could have gone for two more days. I was lucky enough to spend some more time with Mike over the weekend and pick his brain, and I've already texted him a bunch of times since this episode was recorded to ask more and more questions. But we tried to cover as much as we possibly could in this podcast that maybe hasn't been covered as much on other shows. You guys know we got our own style. We try and do our own thing for most of it. One of the things that we jump into at the beginning is kind of the high carb versus high fat for high performance athletes diets, and what works, what doesn't work. Mike has worked with so many athletes throughout the years. He's really seen it all. So he breaks it down for us how come there are some athletes out there who can perform so well on a high-fat diet and then others who need the carbs. Other than that, we talk about outside factors that can influence your body composition. So not just the food, but also the stress, maybe overtraining, all that stuff, HRV, insulin sensitivity, sympathetic versus parasympathetic nervous system, and just all around how to be smarter with your training and your nutrition. I really hope you guys enjoyed as much. Enjoy this one, as I'm getting all excited. I'm flustered over here. So yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed this one as much as we did recording it. On top of that, guys, don't forget, it's still May. We still have the special going on at Chalk Online. So if you guys just head over to crossfitchalk.com, sign up for the Chalk Online programming, which is being used by hundreds and hundreds of people around the gym, and actually we have full affiliates signed up to the program now as well. You guys are going to get the regular CrossFit Chalk programming 7 days a week. On top of that, for 6 days, you guys are getting the sweat program, which is more of a conditioning style, body weight, less complicated movements type of workout, and all of that you're going to get for $20 a month. And if you enter in May, you guys are not only going to get a free ski erg, but you're going to get a full home gym package. So for more information, either head over to Ryan's Instagram at ryanfish.com, head over to our website at CrossFit Chalk. I'm Yaya at Yaya's View, and I'm going to let you guys dive in. Have fun. All right, got my coffee. Where's my coffee? All right.
Do I have to sit a certain distance from you for that, or am I good?
I think we're okay. Yeah.
Actually,
okay.
If you could sit on his lap, that would be ideal.
Yeah, we joke around a lot. Be prepared for that.
No worries.
All right, kids. We're here at Paleo FX, sitting on the couch. Not quite Fish's couch.
Yeah,
but
no, we're still on a couch.
Still on a couch. went to TJ Maxx just for this. Got the couch right across from the Barbell Shrugged booth.
And there's absolutely no way that we're not going to not return it.
Yeah.
So thank you, Target, for having such a great return policy. We have Dr. Mike with us right now.
Who's actually sitting on Fish's lap because his couch is so small.
Which you'll know will be a lie if you watch YouTube. But,
you know.
I'm excited we're on the couch, and we are going to be talking about mental effects towards our fitness goals.
Yep.
So what better to talk to, or who better to talk to than a doctor on the subject? Because if he's a doctor, you have to listen.
A real doctor.
A real doctor. This is a real doctor. Okay, cool. So let's just start with your background.
Yeah.
And who we're talking to, and we'll start getting into some stuff that people just don't know anything about.
Yeah, who the hell are you, man?
Yeah, I'm Dr. Mike T. Nelson. I did a Bachelor of Arts in Natural Science, did a Master's in Mechanical Engineering, Biomechanics, and then did a PhD in Kinesiology, Exercise Physiology.
Cool.
I'm the owner of Extreme Human Performance and also the creator of the Flex Diet Certification.
Oh, okay.
And I work with mostly clients online right now. And then
so when you hear the term flexible dieting, that's you?
Kind of. I took and mashed up flexible dieting with metabolic flexibility.
Okay.
So that's how you got the term flex diet. And also you think of like fitness, flexing, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
But then I teach for Rocky Mountain University online. I'm an adjunct there. And then you'll see the video, a faculty member at the Carrig Institute, where they do a lot of functional neurology. So we're going to talk more about brain stuff, things
yeah.
like that.
Absolutely.
And then I primarily help them with their creation of an exercise and human performance program with Dr. Kenneth Jay and Dr. Freddy Garcia and Dr. Carrig and some of the other people there.
Awesome.
That sounds pretty cool. I mean, that's pretty obvious that you've, like, dedicated your life towards fitness and just, like, improving
yeah.
the metabolic condition. What, like, if we go way, way back, right, where did this, I don't want to say obsession, but this path.
Obsession's fine.
Okay. we'll do obsession then. Yeah. Where did this obsession start?
It probably started, if I think back, even pretty young. So I had an open heart surgery when I was 4 and a half.
Oh, wow.
So I had heart failure when I was like 4, just a hole in the top chamber, so massive swelling of the heart. And just interest in physiology probably from there. Like in high school, I loved physiology. In college, I'm like, oh, this is great. I'm going to do a Bachelor of Arts, so I'll learn more about physiology.
I took exercise physiology as well. And
yeah.
That class was literally – the actual human physiology class was my favorite.
Yeah, and it was so interesting because I never, for a while, didn't even understand the concept of exercise physiology. I'm like, why don't we just have physiology? And I remember one of the first anatomy professors I had, Dr. Cisaldo, was at St. Scholastica in Duluth, Minnesota. Awesome guy. Learned a ton from him. He's like, well, we have exercise physiology because physiology at rest is just kind of boring.
Super boring.
Right. And I'm like, oh. He's like, if we want to figure out how the system really works, he's like, you need to apply a bunch of stress to it and then see what it actually does. And that always kind of stuck with me of like, oh.
It's crazy, too, because you already know it's going to be boring. And then the professor that they give you is usually a super boring professor as well.
It can be. Oh, definitely. Yeah.
My professor at University of Utah, he had like one of those – thick pieces of white saliva stuck to the sides of his mouth. You know what I'm talking about?
The mouth cheese.
So when he would talk, it would just be like gooping.
Yeah, mouth cheese, dude.
So you literally couldn't even listen to him.
That's all you could see.
You're just like, oh my God, I think he's going to blow a goop bubble at me. But but yeah, it definitely can be very boring. But when it comes to exercise, I feel like it could be a lot more exciting because
if you're in that class,
you probably want to get bigger. You want to understand why you're getting bigger or why you're getting faster or stronger or whatever.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it for myself was just, you know, like most guys, you get into it because you know, you want to look better and lift more. And in high school, we had the old presidential fitness test, if anyone remembers that.
I remember that. And if you didn't get presidential, you got the national award.
So horrible. Like, I was, like, the most non-physical person ever. I remember doing that test, and we had to do the pull-up test. So you go up there, and you hang from the bar, and he's like, okay, you can start the test now. And I'm like, I already started. And he's like, you're not moving. I'm like, I can't move. He's like, no, you're supposed to do at least one pull-up. I'm like, I can't. You know, I got squashed by the bar, just an empty bar, trying to do bench press in 10th grade. And it's like a lot of it was just trying to learn to get better myself and what things I need to do and applying it, and then also learning more on the academic side too.
Cool.
The one thing we always talk about on this show is we do a lot of nutrition stuff, and the one thing that we always kind of start with and then follow up with is always that it always comes down to who you are as a person, and everybody is different and
sure.
everything. You know, someone might do fasting, someone might do keto, and it just depends on who you are, what works best for you. But one thing we never talk about is why. Why is every person different, and what makes it different that me, I'm doing a high-carb diet, Fish is doing a low-carb diet, you're doing keto, and all three of those things are just working perfectly for us?
Yeah, I think about it as, and it's a really good topic because it's like, how do you individualize something? And I think in the industry, we go like from one end to like the other end, right? It's like, oh, everyone, like I remember in CrossFit, like for when ketogenic became popular, because I got all these emails from people, they're like,
it's getting more popular now, I feel like.
It's like becoming popular again. Yeah. Like the cycles, I think, are like being shortened. And people would email me and they're like, hey, bro, I need your help. I did a ketogenic diet. I'm doing CrossFit. I'm training one or two times a day. I want to make it to regionals.
And I'm dying.
I felt amazing for 5 weeks. I feel like dog shit now, and I can't figure out why, you know. And but then they'll held up like, you know, some freak that can able to do that.
Yeah.
Right? So you've got the other end. You've got people that are very, very high carb. So I look at it as what are the overarching principles, right? Because we're all human. We all kind of look alike. Metabolism. Right. The basic principles are always going to be true from you to the next person to the next person. So once we understand that, okay, what's the process we go through to individualize it? And then knowing the principles will give you a really good idea of where to start. So if you come in and go, hey, I'm doing more CrossFit stuff, in my brain, I'm like, ooh, ketogenic diet is probably the last thing I'm going to have you do. Why? Because your sport is extremely glycolytic. You're burning through a piss ton of carbohydrates. I'm not going to give you a nutrition plan that basically has no carbohydrates. Like you eat, like sniff half a bagel and boom, you're done with your carbs for a day. You know?
It's like the in dodgeball when the guy is like masturbating with the pizza shoving it down his pants.
And the guy comes in, he's like, what were you doing? He's like, nothing. Absolutely nothing.
But yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. So I think having a little bit of a tiered approach or a way that you're going to walk people through and be like, okay, for the assessment of your goals and what you're doing, your background, what you'd like to do, we're going to have you start here. Now, that doesn't mean I'm going to be 100% or any coach to be 100% right, but it's going to be better here than over here. But then after that, not being so rigid where you're trying to pound the square peg into the round hole. Like I may think you need 300 grams a day and you're like, my performance is okay and I just feel like I'm becoming a fat bastard, right? In my head, I could say, well, you need more carbs. Or I could go, well, based on your current result, maybe we'll scale those back a little bit. Or you get the inverse. You have some people that are at 300 grams of carbs and are like, I think my performance could be better. Cool, let's bump it up and see what happens. So now let's individualize from those starting points and have some markers to figure out if we're going in the right direction.
And then what is going on with the person who, so like for me, for instance, I competed at CrossFit for a high level for like 10 years.
Yeah.
And I went to regionals 7 times and I was like a games alternate a few times, and I like never eat carbs.
Really?
Yeah, like I never really have. I don't even really crave them. I just
so
crave.
When he said low carb, like he's meaning like low carb.
I literally will only like, and back in the day I didn't even eat like any carbs like ever.
Wow.
And like I was gonna ask you the same question. My sister actually is an Olympic athlete, and she went to Rio, plays field hockey, which also is like highly conditioning.
Sure,
sports,
yeah.
So many calories like during a game. And same thing, no carbs. She eats maybe like salads and veggies, and that's absolutely it.
Whoa.
And actually, if she eats carbs, which every now and then, you know, she like craves maybe like a bowl of pasta or something like that, immediately after, she gets so sleepy she can like barely stay awake.
Mm. Oh, yeah, I'm the same too.
Yeah.
And as soon as I try to eat carbohydrates, I do definitely feel like my body fat percent goes up a little bit. And just being in the fitness industry, it's always like my goal to be as lean as possible. So
sure, yeah.
I'm always trying to keep the carbs low just for that. And I always – I do feel like my performance is really good. Like, after a workout, I definitely crave sugar, I think, like anybody else.
Yeah.
And recently in the last, like, probably 2 or 3 years, I'll have a bunch of carbs post-workout, but that'll be it.
Okay. How many is a bunch, just out of curiosity?
Probably like 100 grams.
Okay. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. So with someone like you, like, in my brain, I'm going,
just
okay.
Just to aid, like, for muscle building and stuff.
Yeah.
Like that, but.
With people like that, or even, like, with the, you said it was your sister, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I always wonder, I'm like, have they experimented with the flip of their condition, and is it better once they get through that transition?
How long
right?
is the transition?
Well, that's the tricky part that no one can really tell us right now, whether you're going to, like, say, into keto, or out of keto, or low carb, or high carb. I'll look to see where is the most efficient state to put in carbohydrates and see how they feel. So for someone like you, it would be maybe even during training or right after. Right, because you've got all the counter-regulatory hormones. You've got muscle activation, which will pull glucose right out of the bloodstream. You've got translocation of GLUT4. You've got possibly insulin effects. You've got cortisol to some degree. You've got epinephrine, norepinephrine. If there's any time that your body is better able to, quote-unquote, handle carbohydrates, it's during training and after training. So I will push carbs, like, super high in those people during those windows and see how they do. And then I'll expand out a little bit from there. And then you may find that, hey, you're good with, like, 100 grams post, and you're perfectly fine. You may find that you do even better at other times. Or she may find that her recovery maybe is better, or maybe the type of carbohydrate. Or she may be so low-carb for so long that the muscle can actually be more insulin-resistant, paradoxically, to carbohydrates.
Okay.
Why? Because it's trying to spare glucose for the brain.
So
if you make the muscle more insulin insensitive, which is in a healthy person is a non-pathological condition, it's not a type 2 diabetic, your muscle saying, hey, I don't want to take as much of the glucose because there's so little around, I need to move it to the brain.
Wow.
So I have seen those cases where someone who's been doing very low carb for such a long period of time that having them come back and use carbohydrates, especially with timing, you can see some different issues. And then also, you know, working with their physician to say, okay, what's your fasting glucose? What's your HbA1c? There's another marker of glucose called GlycoMark. So GlycoMark is a blood test you can run to see if that first phase of insulin response is all goofed up. Right? So you've got two phases of insulin response. The first one is primarily controlled by the nervous system. It's very, very short. And you've got the more sustained release. Some people, like my wife we had tested, her HbA1c, which is the about 3 month kind of average of blood glucose, was pretty good. Her fasting blood glucose was also pretty good, was 85. Her GlycoMark was completely wonky. So what we think happens is she gets these massive spikes that go up and then drop really fast. So she has a lot of carbohydrates. She also feels very not so good, sleepy. I feel very tired. I don't really feel that good.
Right.
But if you only looked at fasting and you only looked at a three-month average, you'd say, nah, you're fine.
Yeah.
So we then went a step further and put a continuous glucose monitor on her to see what's actually going on. So it goes out and it takes a measurement every 5 minutes for 2 weeks. And you compare that to your nutrition log, and you can look to see if you're getting these massive excursions that go high and then may go super low on the opposite end, but the average may
like
be
a
okay.
Pendulum. Like as soon as it goes super high, it has to go super low on the other side.
A lot of times, yeah. Mm-hmm. And when it's going super low, they feel like crap.
Right.
So, you know, you can get that in depth just to kind of see what's actually going on. At the end of the day, you may find that, hey, you know, even though it looks like your sport should require more carbohydrates, maybe you're okay without them. I don't know. I always wonder about that because at an elite level, like there's a study done with marathon runners. They gave them, I think it was nicotinamide acid, to block fatty acid use. So they're not using fat at all. And these are very high-level marathon runners. They're running entirely now on carbohydrates. Their performance did not decrement at all.
Which technically shouldn't work because the carbohydrate should burn up super fast in the beginning stages of the run, correct?
Yes and no, because they were allowing them to take in exogenous carbohydrates during.
Okay.
Yeah, they just wanted to see in an elite level runner how much of that is carbohydrate based and how much of that is fat based. So as you get higher levels of performance, you find that pretty much everyone will drift to being more carbohydrate use because of the rate of which you can create energy. Carbohydrates allow you to create energy faster than fat. Fat has a benefit of you can store a lot of it and provide a crap ton of energy, but the rate at which you can produce ATP from it is much slower.
Okay, gotcha. If I'm at home and I'm just kind of starting out my diet journey or whatever you want to call it, because all three of us sitting here, we've tried many trends. Like I've done high carb, low carb kind of stuff. You mentioned there are some markers where if I walked into your office, you could start me out on a trend. You mentioned exercise of those is one, like how often, how intense do you exercise? What are some other ones of those markers just to start me out on my journey?
Yeah, so the very first question, and people come up and they go, hey, what do you think about X diet? I'm like, ketogenic diet. I'm like, well, what are your goals? What are you trying to accomplish, right? So exactly what you said, I'll look to see what exercise you're doing, what level of intensity, how long. If I think people are lying about intensity, I put heart rate monitors on them to try to get a real accurate, you know, picture. It's not that they're intentionally trying to lie. They just really missing some awareness.
Okay.
Other things that I look at now that I didn't look at a couple of years ago are stress. So I put heart rate variability on them, resting heart rate, sleep. So if you use I have an Oura Ring, or you can use like a Fitbit or something like that, just to get a non-invasive marker that's not self-report. So what time do they go to bed and even what time do they get up? Just the number and how many hours they're sleeping.
Okay.
Because we know that if you impair even one night of sleep, like severely, carbohydrate tolerance is shit. And you do that for like 4 or 5 days. University of Illinois did this. You can take people who are healthy and make them borderline type 2 diabetics in less than a week.
Wow.
So if I have someone who I know is pushing training really hard and they're probably sleep deprived, until I can get those turned around, I may opt to not really push carbohydrates super hard.
That's us
with
this
them.
Weekend for sure. I might be diabetic after sleeping only 3 hours
a night. I'm not eating tacos last night.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so even just lifestyle things without getting into blood work, you know, for most people listening that they can do, I find that those are like really big ones.
Okay.
And the last one too is what are they willing to do? Right, because I have some people who are scared to death of fat. I've got other people who are scared to death of carbohydrates. I look at another sweet potato, oh, my God, I'm going to get fat.
Yeah.
You know, whether we can argue all day if we think those things are real or not, to them, it's very real. You know, I've had in the past hour-long consults with a moderately successful CrossFit person. My whole goal at the end of the conversation was I wanted to get them to eat one more freaking sweet potato. Because they were so low on carbohydrates, their performance had dropped, that I'm like, this is probably the low-hanging fruit. This is the most easy thing to test first. But they're like, oh, I know my performance is crap, but I'm going to get fat. And I'm like, well, one, have you tested that? And two, you told me that performance was your goal, not body comp. So what is your goal? Is your goal body comp? No, it's performance. I'm like, but you're sounding like you're telling me your goal is body comp.
Yeah.
I don't care what your goal is. Either one's cool. Do whatever you want, man. That's awesome. But you can't say I want this and then do that.
I didn't understand the difference between those two things until I actually started CrossFit.
Yeah.
And oh, sure.
I was working out really hard all my life. I played football, high school, college, semi-pro, all the way through. And I've talked to nutritionists and coaches, and they've all said those things. And it's just kind of one of those things where you can hear it 100 million times.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
But you just kind of... Yeah, exactly. In through one ear, out through the other, and then all of a sudden one thing hits and you just experience it and you're like, oh my God, I fucking get it. And that moment for me was CrossFit, where when I started CrossFit, I just wasn't eating enough.
Yeah.
And I felt like, well, the reason why I started CrossFit at the time was because I got done with football and I wanted to work out and just kind of go into the gym and doing 5x5 bench press just wasn't cutting it.
Yeah.
Because I was so used to the competition factor
of
working out. So then CrossFit stepped in. I was like, this is fucking perfect. Like, I'm going to get shredded, get big, all that stuff. But I was still eating the same way I was eating when I was doing 5x5 bench press. And I burned out so super fast. Just tired all the time, sluggish, terrible workouts, just foggy. Right? And that's when I noticed that it's like, all right, I got to eat just to fuel my workouts. And then everything else just has to be secondary.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think you also made the decision that, correct me if I'm wrong, but performance was a little bit higher than body comp.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and people can do both, but they have to realize that, okay, I'm trying to do both, And at some point when I work with people, it's like, okay, where's your threshold? Right? For someone, it may be, dude, if I get above 7% body fat, I'm a fat bastard. You know, for other people, it's like, I'm trying to get below 30%, right? Everyone has their own threshold of where they want to be. And then, okay, what is your performance? What are your performance measures? Okay, and if you want to do both, what compromises, where you want to be between those? Because you can do both, but you're going to have to compromise a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
And there are, like, absolute freaks that can do both, no question.
Yeah, but it's weird.
They're not normal.
I never eat carbs, but my big question here, and I like really, really want to know the answer to this. I feel like I know it a little bit, but I think you might be able to break it down better. So let's say I'm the person who truly believes that either A, fat is going to make me fat, or B, carbs are going to make me fat. Let's say I take your advice and I'm like, all right, Dr. Mike says I'm going to do this and it's going to get me to my goal. But I truly, truly believe that it's going to make me fat. Is my consciousness of me actually believing that, does that actually lead to me becoming fat? Like, is there such a stress level that you're blocking off different receptors and such where it's actually becoming true? Or will I just find out, like, physiologically on my own?
I would say yes.
You can raise cortisol high enough to actually fuck yourself up, right? If you're actually stressed about eating the extra sweet potato.
Yeah, so I would say yes and no, right? So on one hand, right, the hardcore calories in, calories out people would say doesn't matter, right? If you follow calories in, calories out, it's going to work out. Physics is going to win, right?
Okay.
And yes, do I 100% agree with that? Absolutely. The hard part is that people, and they'll point to metabolic chamber studies. We lock people in this metabolic chamber. We control all their movement. We control all their food. High, high, high control. Yes, calories in, calories out always works. The hard part is that humans live in an open environment and a free living. And you add to the fact that a lot of humans do things subconsciously that they probably don't even know that they're doing. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is like the world's biggest monkey wrench. Because do the physics work? Absolutely. Can you 100% all the time rely on exactly what the client is telling you?
No.
Sadly, no. And it's not that the client is bad or that they're trying to lie to you. But what I've noticed is that their sub-belief is that I eat more carbs, I'm going to become fat. And I tell them to eat one more banana. I know that that's not enough to add up to even a pound of fat. It is, the physics are not even remotely close. Now, do I think they may subconsciously alter other behaviors to move themselves to a poor self-fulfilling prophecy?
So they eat the banana and they work out more?
I think they might, right?
Yeah.
And what you see is in studies, as you start lowering the calories, right, people will spontaneously move less, but they won't really report it because it's almost like an unconscious thing, right? Because their body is adapting to less calories coming in. I'm going to start slowing things down, right? Which is where you get into, my metabolism shut down, all these other things. So what I like to do is I say, okay, I want to get as much hard data as I can within reason. So if I think you're moving less, I'm going to put a watch or an Oura Ring on you and see how many steps per day do you take. If you went from 12,000 steps to 4,000 steps, and you're telling me I got fat because I ate a banana at the same time, I'm like, no, it's probably more your movement, right? And I can show them the data and say, now let's do the reverse. Let's go back up to 10,000 steps per day or 8,000 or whatever, and do we kind of even out at that point? And I think that's where kind of the art of coaching and that sort of thing comes in. So I always want to know, what do I think their core belief is? And a lot of times I do kind of want to challenge it a little bit, but not so far that I feel like I'm going to start losing their trust also. Yeah. You know, and if you add, like, you know, especially female athletes, if you add fluid retention, you add different electrolytes, you're training in the hot environment or not, sleep, stress, all those things like you mentioned, fluid level can actually change quite a bit. Like it's
like you flying on the airplane.
Yeah, I was we were talking about that yesterday. I felt like super puffy and just bloated and big, and I was just like, I asked Fish, like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah, I mean, with like some more competitors, I remember one competitor. I told her, I said, okay, she's like, I'm not losing weight, blah blah blah, and she's getting ready for a show, and she's already very lean. And I said, okay, for tonight, I want you to go home, and I want you to have 30 grams of carbohydrates of white rice at dinner, because that's what she liked. Oh, my God, I can't eat an extra 30 grams of carbohydrates. I'm like, I absolutely guarantee you 30 grams are not going to make you fatter, and I bet that you'll probably show up leaner tomorrow morning. She's like, well, you're full of shit. There's no way. I'm like, just do it once, and let's just see what happens, okay? So does it once. She loses, like, 2 pounds.
Overnight.
Why? Probably because it was enough of a carbohydrate bump to possibly drop her cortisol to get her body to release some fluid because we dropped her stress level a little bit.
Gotcha.
Again, hypothetical. Who knows exactly why?
Yeah.
That's what
happened a lot of times.
I really think that stress level thing is, like, something to really focus on.
I agree 100%.
Like, me personally, if I – because I am so not used to eating carbs for years and years and years.
Yeah.
I'll eat a sweet potato and instantly just, like, feel sick to my stomach because I feel like I, like – I'm a dog and I just pissed on the bed. I just feel like it was such a terrible idea, and I like mentally make myself feel bad about it. So I give myself the sad dog face.
Yeah.
And I feel like that could definitely like mentally create some cortisol levels that are not okay.
But also swing completely the other way. I mean, we always talk about this. When I started at Chalk, I kind of came off like a super strict training regimen, and also my outside gym life was almost non-existent.
Yeah.
I was in a gym all day, every day. Outside of the gym, I was sleeping during my recovery and eating freaking chicken and broccoli, and that's completely it. And then I came to Chalk. My life kind of shifted a little bit. I defocused from training and focused more on, like, living my life and becoming happier outside of the gym also. And I was working out way less. I mean, before that, I was working out close to 4.5-5 hours a day.
Oof.
And then I was doing just class. I would show up 6 a.m., do an hour workout, and then be done for the rest of the day. Maybe, like, play basketball or something like that, but nothing inside the gym anymore. And I was getting leaner and leaner and better looking, and I was just so happy when I saw myself in the mirror. As time progressed with working out 3 hours less a day, and the same thing, the only thing I can trace it back to is just the stress levels.
Yeah, and especially if you start getting into – and I've had – you know, I think every coach trainer has clients that – for whatever reason, you just don't get a result from. I mean, I'd be really worried if someone says, I get a result with 100% of people 100% of the time.
Everybody is so different.
I doubt that. And I find that the clients I have the hardest time with are ones that are usually a little bit older, have a little bit more injuries, and are just very, very stressed, whether the stress comes from training, whether it comes from their outside life, things of that nature. They just – it's very hard to see a change in them. And I think a lot of times we're like, oh, calories in, calories out. That overly focusing on that, I think, sometimes can be a detriment. And to your effect, I've seen I don't know how many people where you just overtrain them. And I've had people, like, not even train sometimes for 2 weeks. They do their HRV and wait till their HRV comes up and they're back to normal. And I said, don't consciously change anything, right? I know they probably will, but I said, just don't change anything. Go for walks. Do light movement. Do not go to the gym.
Absolutely.
And if they can do it, which is very rare because it's very, very hard to do that, almost every time they're like, dude, I look better. I'm a lot leaner. And they go back to the gym and test their weight, and they're, like, up quite a bit.
Stronger than everything. Yeah.
Right.
100%.
Right. Because if you're so overtrained or so sympathetic, you just haven't recovered. Your body is not in a state to perform, and you add, you know, cortisol and probably water weight and who knows all the other factors we haven't even probably figured out yet. It just tends to compound it, and then a lot of times their immune system takes a hit, and they get sick.
Right.
Yeah.
So what do you? So for someone who's maybe not even a competitor, but for someone who just works out really, really hard, I would say most people who are listening to this, we probably have like 30% competitors listening to this, and 70% of people who are just interested in fitness stuff.
Sure, yeah, cool. We'll go with that.
Let's just say I work out at Gold's and I work out super hard. How many weeks until I should take like a week off or three days off or 4 days off? And how many days do you think you should take off?
Yeah, that's a really good question. In my experience, what I'll do with clients when I initially get them is I'll just run old school linear volume periodization, which they're like, I paid you a shit ton of money for this. This is so basic and boring. I'm like,
but it works. It's gold standard.
Yes. Because I may literally have them do one set. You're like, you want me to go to the gym on week one and do one set of each exercise? I'm like, yes. Why? Because if I start super low and I build you back up, wherever you drop off is where you drop off, right? But if I said, look at your past, and I think you can start at three sets or X amount of volume, and I'm wrong, crap. Now I got to go all the way back down taper you, deload up. You, go back up again. So I'm like, just give me a couple weeks. I promise you, within 3 to 4 to 5 weeks, you will not want to go to the gym. You will not want to do any more work. And I literally just add one set each week. So they may start at one or two sets, and then the next week, one more set. So now they're at three sets, four sets, five sets. I track their resting heart rate and HRV, and then their kind of willingness to train. Like, are you excited to go to the gym? And then usually within 4 to 6 sets of, like, 4 to 5 days a week, they're just like, no, I can't do anymore. I'm done.
Yeah.
And then I'll be like, all right, so let's take a taper. And usually their taper, I just super simple. I cut their volume in about half to maybe even 60%, because a lot of times they still want
to go to the
gym. And
how long are we talking
about? I just run in 1 week. I usually do week blocks.
Are we like about 6 weeks in right now?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You said 4 to 6 sets, but you didn't say how long.
Yeah, I usually find that it's about 4 to 7 weeks.
Okay.
So if I had to put a number on it, I'd say 4 to 5 weeks, somewhere around there. Now, some of that maybe.
And that's just a deload you're talking about, not actually taking off.
Deload, yep. Okay. Yep. So I'll literally just whack their volume at about 50%. With competitors, it works pretty good. So I worked with a guy who is a powerlifter, was looking to qualify for Raw Nationals, which he did. And for those people who's a little bit more experienced, it tends to be more prolonged. So he would run about 6 weeks, and then when we're off season, his tapers would be about a week, just because of his lifestyle, that was easier. But then when we got up to a meet, we would run a little bit longer, and then his taper ended up being about 10 days. And we just used HRV. So I said his first time, he's like, okay, in the past, he's like, I've always done a 7-day taper. He's like, that just works. I said, well, let's do this. Let's give you 2 weeks this time, and let's watch your HRV. And when your HRV drops, we're going to start your taper, and then we're going to wait for it to recover and then just come down again. And if we have 2 weeks, that's more than enough time to be able to see that. And if it looks like you're early, we'll just add one or two more days of, you know, prep or just some stimulation work or whatever. If we're wrong on that time frame, if we think it's 7 days and you're still not recovered at the end of the 7 days, you're kind of effed at that point, right? You can't, you got to do the meet or do the competition on that day. In his case, you know, it was right about in the middle.
And when you say he's recovered or not recovered, I know you've mentioned HRV, and I want to get to that later in the show. What are some other factors that you take into consideration saying that he's recovered?
Yeah, so a lot of it is if you really push people, you get, like, sleep disturbances that don't feel good. If you look at the research, like, willingness to train is, like, a huge one. So I always track. You just put in your log, you know, 1 through 10, how willing did you want to train? Performance-wise, how was the session? Right, if your performance is all of a sudden tanking and you don't feel like you want to train, you probably need to taper or deload, or your recovery is just utter crap and you need to rethink your life.
Your entire life.
Yeah, rethink your life.
Just look in the mirror for 45 minutes.
Yeah, and your values.
That's your homework tonight.
Yeah. So I find it varies. Like total time, 4 to 7-ish weeks. Time off, I usually run in weeks just because – a lot of people like the calendar. They like Monday squat day, Wednesday's deadlift. They like that kind of consistency. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I just default to that because of kind of the mental side of what they like and enjoy. But again, if they're more elite competitors and they're really pushing volume, I'll probably run stuff out a little bit longer just to see how that plays out.
And during that, the 4 to 5 weeks that we said where they're actually working,
yeah.
Did you say it was 3 days on, 2 days? One day off, 2 days on, one day off.
It depends. Like, I have everyone on I've had some people on a 2-day template. I've had some people who are like, dude.
2 days a week?
Yeah. They're like, dude, my life is hell Monday through Friday. I've got kids. I drive an hour each way. They're like, I physically can't fit any time in the gym. So they train for an hour and a half Saturday and Sunday. Is that ideal or quote-unquote optimal? Probably not. But is it better than anything else they could probably do at that time unless they just rearrange their whole life? Yeah. Most people I have, like 4 days is pretty average for weight training. They may do some light cardio on the opposite days, too. I tend to do them on different days.
That's a perfect segue into my next question. I know a lot of CrossFitters do the active recovery day.
Yeah.
And I think it's a wide spectrum of recovery days going on there,
for
right?
Sure. Yeah.
There's the active recovery day where I just do like a warm water yoga session in the morning. And then there's other active recovery days where people are in the gym for 2.5 hours and are going from bike to road to ski.
Yeah.
And
all out.
Yeah, exactly. So do you implement active recovery days? And if yes, what are like the parameters that you have your athletes within?
Yeah. The simplest template I ever use, which again is a little bit more for intermediate athletes, is Monday, Wednesday, Friday, maybe Saturday, some type of lifting, anaerobic, 5x5. There's a bunch of different routines you can use. Split out the work as much as possible. I'm a big fan of splitting out the work over the course of all of those days. Tuesday, Thursday, maybe an optional Sunday. Just get up in the morning if you can and do some type of fasted cardio, moderate to low intensity, right? So you can use the Phil Moffitone's equation. So 180 minus your age. So if I'm 43, my max I'm still looking at is around 137, 140. And I will actually put heart rate monitors on people, especially if they tell me they do CrossFit. First thing I'll do is like put a heart rate monitor on, do your recovery day, send me your data. And I show it to them and go, 10 beats off your max. Do you think this is recovery work?
Yeah.
And they're like, well, you should see my lifting days. I'm like, cool, that's your next object. You know, go out, put this on during your lifting day. And usually there's not enough contrast between them. That's probably the simplest thing I do. And then I will also usually, in more advanced people, change their carbohydrate levels. So lifting days will be usually much higher on carbohydrates, usually pre, sometimes mid and post, definitely pre and post.
Mm-hmm.
And then recovery work, if possible, I have them do it fasted or semi-fasted. So if they can't get it done in the morning, which is fine, they said, I can only do it at 3 in the afternoon. Cool, just have a normal meal at noon, and then probably not much before you go do your run at 2 or 3 or cycle or ergometer or whatever, and then we'll have a little bit more carbs, you know, kind of after.
And so what are some benefits you've seen with the fasted active recovery?
I think I'm trying to match their bioenergetics to the exercise, which the model I use then is it's called the more of a eustress model. So E-U-S-T-R-E-S-S, that you're matching the energy intake to what you're burning. So if you're going to go out and do this crazy wad, you're going to burn through a piss ton of carbohydrates. I want you to have a piss ton of carbohydrates probably on board or going to be replaced relatively soon.
Yep.
If your goal is recovery work, and you're trying to increase the body's aerobic base, I'm trying to increase the body's ability to use fat, we know that if I bump up insulin before, that intensity is going to push you a little bit more towards carbohydrate use.
Yep.
So I want you to stay more on the fat burning side. Fat burning, which, you know, gets bastardized.
Sure.
But I'm trying to selectively use more fat to run that aerobic engine.
And when you're fasted, correct me if I'm wrong, you increase like hormone levels, correct? So you get a little bit of extra growth hormone output?
You do, but I don't think that makes any difference.
Oh, it doesn't make
any difference. One study that looked at that in terms of lactate. So if you do a really heavy lactate session, it is true that you do get more growth hormone. Do those acute anabolic hormones matter? I think you could almost make a slight argument for growth hormone. I think growth hormone is more of a fuel selector than it is a thing by itself.
Okay.
Meaning that if you're fasted, you are absolutely correct that growth hormone will go up, but I think that's because growth hormone is also pushing your body to use more fat.
Okay.
So I think the cause and effect sometimes gets reversed. If we look at studies from Dr. West, who's out of Stu Phillips' lab, they did studies looking at acute testosterone release. They've done three of those studies now looking at hypertrophy, and the first one they did was a brilliant study. So all the stuff from like Bill Kramer and everyone else that says, hey, if you go to the gym and you do super heavy squats and we go measure your testosterone goes up. And that's absolutely true. The follow-up question is, does that actually matter? Does that acute bump in testosterone make any damn difference at all? So what Dr. West did is they said, okay, you come in the lab Monday. We're going to have you do squats, and then we're only going to exercise your right bicep on that day, right? That's the high hormone condition, right? Squats bump testosterone. You're exercising your right bicep under high levels of testosterone. Take a couple days off, come back into the lab. Now do the reverse. Exercise your left bicep first, and then go squat.
Wow, that's cool.
Why? Left bicep is now exercised under a low hormone condition. But the work and every volume, everything else is identical between the two groups. Hmm. And what they showed was no difference between either one of the groups. They've repeated that study with a little bit different version. Ronstadt, who's out of Denmark, did show some difference on exercise order in terms of acute hormone release. Stu Phillips then took their data and analyzed it a different way and said, no, if you analyze it this way, there's no effect really. So at least with testosterone, we've got pretty good data to show that those acute levels from exercise don't appear to matter at all. Now, again, we're talking about a very acute level that's elevated and then drops down. We're not talking about people using high amounts of exogenous hormones that are completely out of the range and being elevated chronically for days to weeks to months.
Yeah. So what do you think was the ideal training schedule for someone who's been, like, working out for 5, 6, 10 years? Maybe they're pretty advanced and they still think they need to work out, like, 5, 6 days a week. What do you have to say about that? Like, what do you think is the best scenario?
Yeah.
Because I work out 5 days a week. Cool. I take off, like, the same days every time. I always take off Thursday and Sunday.
Okay.
But I've really, really been wanting to try a three-day-a-week workout just to see if I could look the same and work out less.
Yeah.
And maybe just do a little bit higher volume on those days. But I think it would feel amazing.
Yeah, I would bet. So what I've seen is that if your goal then was to only maintain what you have, I would bet you could probably drop down to 1 day a week or maybe 2 days.
Wow.
What
and
I've
still
seen
maintain.
Is, yeah, totally.
Even your leanness and your muscle size, everything?
In my experience, I would say yes.
Wow.
Now, if you told me you want to get bigger and stronger on 1 day a week,
yeah,
that's going to be
a really hectic
really
day.
Hard. I know a couple of guys who have done it just because of their schedule. What I've noticed is to maintain a physiologic quality doesn't take that much work, right? So if you have someone who trains really hard in their cardiovascular stuff, maybe 1, 2 days a week they do cardiovascular stuff, they can kind of keep their aerobic side pretty good. Now,
that's
if
really
they
cool.
drop to zero, holy shit, it's going away pretty fast.
Yeah, I can
right?
feel that for sure.
Yeah. Now, muscle is different because muscle is such a slow process that size-wise, you probably won't lose for quite a while. Now, strength, you probably would because you're not practicing that skill.
Mm-hmm.
So what I tell people is if you run this experiment, do it 1 or 2 days, and then when you go back to test, let's say, your squat strength, your first test day may be pretty shitty. But do it at least 1 or 2 more times because you may have lost the skill of squatting a heavy weight. And if that'll come back within probably 1 or 2 exposures, and you're probably still okay. The mistake I see people make is, I'm just going to do 1 or 2 days a week. I do that for a couple months. Holy shit, I went back and tested my max squat, and it was off by, like, 10 pounds.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, dude, one, that could vary by...
That's actually awesome. I would
your
take that.
Your testing day, right?
Yeah.
Or 20 pounds or whatever. And it's like, but if you haven't practiced that for 3 months, you probably may not have lost that contractile tissue. You may have just lost a little bit of that skill of not practicing it per se. But I think maintaining and trying to gain are like completely different. Because I'll take periods of time where even like down here, I was in South Padre kiteboarding for 14 days and I only went to the gym twice. But
I've heard that's an amazing place to kiteboard, by the way.
Oh, dude, it's so nice.
I've heard it's so cool.
But I'm out, riding 12 out of the 14 days, beating the shit out of myself doing that. And I would get up and I'd run usually most mornings, do some meditation, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So it wasn't like I was not doing anything. Now, I know if you said, let's go test your max deadlift right now, it's probably not going to be that good. But I've done it enough to know that if I go back home, get in a nice routine, I kind of sleep more, eat a little bit better, all those things, within probably 2 weeks, it's not going to be that far off.
Totally.
Like I tested it when I was in Costa Rica, and it was only off by like 20, 30 pounds. It wasn't...
Yeah, that's not bad
It wasn't that bad, and that could be just a variation on the day that I tested it, too.
Yeah.
So it's... Yeah, I think there's a pretty big discrepancy between there. So to answer your question, what would be ideal? It depends on their goals and what they want to do. I will do as much specific practice as I can get away with to improve that skill as long as they can recover. So if you said, hey, I want to start deadlifting more and I'll do whatever you tell me and my aerobic base is pretty good so I can recover from work, I've got experience deadlifting, I've had people deadlift 4 or 5 days a week.
Yeah.
Now I'll rotate them through. Like you may do a Jefferson, you may do a shovel deadlift, you may do conventional, and then maybe a block pull. Mm-hmm. Right. So I'm not going to have you do the exact same movement all the time because that just destroys people mechanically. But if you kind of vary it around, you can usually get away with a fair amount of volume with it.
Like West Side Barbell style? Where they change
yeah, I mean, West Side Barbell, right? I mean, those dudes are, you know, drugs aside, I mean, those are massive dudes moving massive weight.
Yeah, but they have, like, those 2 days a week sessions where it's super heavy one day, and then the next time is, like, a tempo.
Yep.
Where it's, like, speed work, and it's, like, 50% effort.
Yeah, and they rotate through.
And they change the movements every single time, which I think is super interesting. Like, Louis Simmons says he didn't squat for 10 years. And he PR'd his back squat.
Yeah, that. On one hand, like my brain's like, wow, that's
impossible,
amazing, and doesn't seem to be true. But they're obviously doing something that works. And then on the other side, you know, Jeremy Lenneke, who's done a lot of work, he's had really good results in his lab by having people deadlift 90%+ at a pretty high frequency
all the time.
A fair amount for short periods of time, right? Not for years.
And the Bulgarian Olympic lifters.
Bulgarian Olympic lifters, same thing, right? Because said principle, so specific adaptation to pose demand, would say that the fastest way to get better at that is to do direct practice. And so I tend to agree with that, but I've noticed some people just get the shit beat out of them, mm-hmm. right? And look at the Bulgarian system, right? So they were notorious, again, drugs aside, notorious for just chewing through lifters. And in their system, it didn't matter. Right, if you can't hack it, dude, we've got 1,000 other people that would give their left nut to be right where you are. See you later, Bob. Get over here.
And in a few, but they're all getting tossed in the recycling bin. Like they're all jacked. They look like Mr. Potato Head fell apart every time. Dude.
Oh yeah. I mean, for longevity, horrible idea.
Horrible idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
We were talking about longevity a lot this whole weekend, and like in the last like week or two, and we were at a gym recently here in Austin, and they talk about having classes called durability classes.
Yeah.
And I thought that was, like, the most interesting thing. I was like, that's really cool to be able to give people things that are actually,
was it at Onnit?
It was at Onnit.
Yeah, I love those guys.
it was just cool that they were doing stuff that was, like, you know, in that direction, like durability and longevity and stuff like that. I think it's really cool.
Yeah, I think.
I don't think you understand that, though, until you're, like, 30 plus.
No, I mean, I.
I mean, you understand it younger, but, like, I don't really think that you, like, know that you need it until you start getting a little older.
No, I've had this discussion with I don't know how many coaches and stuff now. I'm like, you see a young person come in like their early 20s, right? And you're like, oh my gosh, I can see the path that you're going down.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And I can see that you're successful now, but I guarantee within 3 to 5 years, you're not going to be happy, right? But to try to talk them out of that path almost – I think it's almost impossible at this point.
It is.
So what I do with people, I don't know if it's right or wrong, is can I get them to just skirt a little bit to the right, and can I literally get them to screw up but not as bad? Can I get them to screw up enough that they learn the lesson but they didn't debilitate themselves? Mm-hmm. Because I can't really get them to not mess themselves up no matter what I do.
It's the whole analogy when you have a kid, they have to touch the stove pot just to burn themselves a little bit and get it. All right, that's hot. Let's not do that again.
Yeah, it's like how – and I literally think about this. How can I get them to do a controlled mistake where it's bad enough that they'll learn but not – in a perfect world, not injure them? Not that I'm trying to injure anyone.
No,
right?
Absolutely.
It's the same people who come to you and go, hey, dude, I want you just to beat the shit out of me. I'm not going to listen to a damn thing you say. I don't care how many degrees. I don't care how many CrossFit people you've gotten to regionals and in the games. I'm not going to listen to you unless you just pound the crap out of me. And normally I don't work with those people. But in the past I have, and so I thought, okay, what can I do to them that will just metabolically wreck them without injuring them? Right? And you come up with, and everyone else has done this too, hey, let's go push the car. Let's do reverse sled drags. Let's go pound on a tire. Let's do high concentric stuff that feels. I mean, like reverse sled drags on your quads are just miserable.
Yeah.
But you usually don't get injured with that. It's not a high-skill movement. Anyone can put in the right mechanics. There's not much eccentric. You're not having a lot of load. The risk of injury is very low, but, man, it feels hard. And then once they kind of buy into that, you kind of try to get them a little less stupid stuff. But sometimes you got to go that route just to get their
buy-in. Yeah, you totally do, yeah. I have some people in our gym right now that just – will not stop working out just all day, every day type of thing. Or, you know, they'll work out for like 2 hours and you see them in the gym again. They're working out for 2 hours again.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you say that to them. You're like, oh, no, I only worked out for like 30 minutes, 40 minutes or whatever. And it's like, okay.
Yeah. And I mean, I have good friends with Dr. Pat Davidson. He's got a program called Mass 1 and Mass 2. And it's just absolutely heinous. And Pat's like a friggin' genius. But the program is so horrible. It's like all, you know, like bench press, incline press, what is it, squat, deadlift, and pull-ups, I think. All like 20-second work, 40-second rest, and you cycle through five for like multiple sets. Just utterly heinous. Does it work? Yeah, absolutely. But in his model, and his model is that I'm going to make the work so hard and so heinous that you will have to change the rest of your life or you will never complete it, right? So it's kind of targeted to those people who are like super goal-driven. I can do this. You're not going to tell me not to do it. I could make an argument that for some people that may be the only approach that works for them. Mm-hmm. That's not where I start, but I think for some people that definitely works for them. You know?
I think CrossFit is like that.
And CrossFit very much is on that.
Right, where like yeah. once you walk into a gym, I experienced the same thing coming from football, and all we were doing was just weightlifting in the gym, and there wasn't really any coaching. It was just, here's a barbell, there's a lot of weight on it, pick it up, put it over your head type of thing. And then you get into CrossFit, and you realize, damn, I can't keep up unless I'm sleeping, I'm eating, I'm doing my recovery.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm either going to get injured, or I'm just never going to get good at this.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah, yeah.
100% the same thing. All right, let's shift a little bit.
Yeah.
And let's go from body to mind. Let's go just upstairs a little bit.
Sure.
So I know that there are a lot of implications that food and diet and just your recovery has also on your mind. What is some experience that you've had like with that with your clients?
Yeah, the biggest thing I found, and you can get into like what is central versus peripheral fatigue, right? So a lot of times people are like, oh, your CNS is burnt. I'm like, on one hand, I've experienced that, and I know what that feels like. On the other hand, I'm like, well, what the hell are they talking about? You know, and you look at the research, there's some cool studies. One of them was an old study from the 90s from Andrew Fry, where he took people and said, okay, I think you're going to do Olympic weightlifting. You're going to do 90-plus percent of your one rep max on Monday, and then Tuesday, and then Wednesday, and Thursday. I think he did for 7 days in a row just to see what happens, right? So muscular-wise, right, concentric load, not that much damage going on, but a very high kind of neural effect. What he saw was, like, willingness to train, things like that were the first things to show up. Performance would definitely drop, too. And he said by the end of the 7 days, he's like, no one wanted to go to the gym anymore. They said, this sucks. This is horrible. I don't want to do this. So there is some component to that. Second, you can look at some of the old studies where they did just like leg extensions. So, okay, do leg extensions till max. All right. Well, now if we think that there's a difference between central versus peripheral, what can we do to see if we can get this muscle to work more? Oh, we'll take a high amount of electric stim and hook it up to the quad and see if we can zap the shit out of it and see if it'll do anything else. Oh, lo and behold, it will. So if you override the central mechanism and directly stimulate the muscle in a human, you will get more work out of it.
Wow, okay.
So that kind of is some data to show that, well, maybe there is something to these central effects. Yeah, like Tim Noakes would say it's a central governor theory.
That can't feel good, by the way.
You know what's interesting is that if you've ever been shocked by those things, they hurt like bloody hell.
Yeah.
The ones that actually work. So what they did in a further study is because the receptors, that are pain receptors, are primarily in the skin.
Okay.
And when you run the current through the skin, you're hitting all those receptors, and it hurts. It hurts really bad.
Yeah.
So what they did is brilliant. They took a round induction loop. So they take a loop, run current through it, and you create a magnetic field that you can induce current via what's called the right-hand rule into a wire. So putting a wire in a large magnetic field will induce a current the direction of your thumb in the wire. So they put this massive induction loop over the main nerve to get the nerve to run energy down, and they bypass all the pain receptors.
Oh, no way.
Because the theory was, and I agree, that creating so much pain may actually have changed the output because it was so painful.
Right.
But, yeah, so anyway, getting back to the question, I think there is something to central issues versus peripheral type issues.
Okay.
And was your question more related to mental stuff and recovery?
Right.
I think the biggest thing is people just need to be able to down-regulate. So can you get to be more parasympathetic? Now, if you look at the autonomic nervous system, you've got your parasympathetic side, which is primarily your vagal nerve, and putting pressure like on the gas pedal of your car. I push on the pedal harder and the car slows down. On the sympathetic side, I can step harder on the gas pedal and the car is going to accelerate. A lot of people, especially I've noticed some CrossFit athletes, are really good on the sympathetic side. Man, you tell me we're going to go do my favorite WOD today. I'm going to have like 4 cups of coffee. This is going to be the greatest thing ever. And then like 4 hours later, they're running around still like, ah! You know, they can't. They can't down-regulate, like, at all. And what I found anecdotally is that their recovery capacity is just not very good. Mm-hmm. But you look at a buddy of mine trains a lot of NHL guys, and he would say his biggest predictor for who's going to stay in the league the longest time, he's like, is who can down-regulate. He's like, we'll have guys come in that are just sympathetic monsters. They can go out, they can hammer and hit guys, and their performance is amazing. He's like, for about 1 to 2 years. And yep. Then they burn up and no one ever hears from them again. He's like, the guys who can go out and perform at a high level, they can come back and just down-regulate and they'll sit and just be fine.
The Tom Brady's that can play 12 seasons without.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And you can even see this even more in like quarterbacks and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. You've got certain quarterbacks in the NFL who physical performance-wise should be light years ahead of everyone else.
Absolutely.
But you'll see them get stressed or pressured. And you'll see them make poor decisions, right? So I think some of that is a skill acquisition thing, but I think some of it is how their brain is processing under a high level of stress. And then also, if they realize that they're having that stress, can they get themselves to calm down a little bit, even being in a very stressful environment,
mm-hmm.
right? So the military does this really well. Like you look at like Navy SEALs and how they train. They do so much intense training that they literally almost get flipped. Like, so they'll go into a very stressful situation and they'll be actually quite calm. But a lot of them, like when you see them are done, like going
just
to the grocery store.
They've adapted to the outside stressors so much that it just doesn't bother them anymore?
Yeah, they're very, because it's also, they've done so much training that it becomes almost a controlled environment for
them.
That's
like their baseline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is what you want.
Totally.
Right, because you don't want someone to have a massive stress response in the wrong environment. But I can imagine if you're so used to that, man, can you imagine just going to the grocery store and just kind of doing day-to-day tasks, I think would be harder almost to adapt to because it's so different.
Yeah.
You know, so the system is super plastic where you can go so far the other direction. And granted, that takes a lot of time,
a lot
of training, very specific circumstances that you can adapt to that. But it takes some time. So I think being able to down-regulate, to once you're done with training, can you sit in the corner and just do some belly breathing for a while? Can you write out your training journal? Just get your heart rate even back down to semi-normal and not run around like a crazy idiot for 4 hours afterwards.
And
that's fun to do once in a while.
Yeah.
But
and that was going to be my next question. You said there's a certain aspect of that that's just skill acquisition.
Yes.
And before we get into maybe supplements and all
yeah.
that stuff, what are some of those skills that you can teach yourself and learn to maybe get better at down-regulating?
Yeah, so one of the ones I like to use a lot is, I talked to Bledsoe about this too, is RPR, so Reflexive Performance Reset. You can do specific work on yourself or you can have someone else help you with it. And it gives you better access to control breathing. And breathing is probably the biggest, I would say, window to the autonomic nervous system. So if I sat here and I told you just start breathing super fast, I guarantee your heart rate will go up, right? Because heart rate is coupled to breathing rate. Why? Because the heart has to deliver oxygen and all those things. The reverse is true. If you start breathing just very slow and relaxed, your heart rate starts coming down, right? And everyone kind of knows this, but that gives you a way of controlling your autonomics, controlling parasympathetic to sympathetic.
And it's your muscles and everything too. You know, if you're like super tense because you're stressed out about something, you might be actual like tense, like your muscles may be flex to a certain point, and once you start breathing correctly and you take deep breaths in and out, you feel yourself, like your entire body, just physically actually relaxing.
Oh yeah, because your body is wired for survival, right? So if you get super, so imagine you're like paleo man, right, since we're at paleo effects, wandering through the paleo desert or whatever
paleo
you
man.
are, and you see the saber-toothed tiger, you're like, wah, you're gonna run as fast as possible, right?
Yeah.
So you want as much muscular gross motor output as possible. You want as much blood flow to the muscle as humanly possible. Are your muscles probably going to be a lot more tense? Absolutely, because it's going to tighten the tendons. It's going to give you more reflex and all that kind of stuff. The hard part is that a lot of humans now are under high levels of stress with, like, no movement, right? So you think about the person working at their desk job, their boss yelling at them all day, and they're sitting at their keyboard scared out of their mind, right? They have completely uncoupled stress with movement,
yeah.
Right? And I think that's why something like CrossFit is also potentially so beneficial, because your stress and movement are more coupled. You just can't really take it to the nth degree and stay in that state all the time.
Okay.
So I think of matching the stressor to the state, and then what state do you want to be in?
Right.
If you're doing a max one rep lift, by all means, be as sympathetic as possible. Is that going to help you in an advanced lifter? Absolutely. Right. Gross motor skills go way up. Right. Just look at power lifters. Guys hitting them on the chest, nose torque, you know, shitloads of caffeine. And in advanced lifters, that all helps their lift, right? That enhances gross motor skill. However, you don't really see many Olympic lifters doing that, right? Olympic lifters still moving a lot of load, less load comparatively, more fine motor skills.
Is that almost the same skill that the Navy SEAL has then, that they're able to go out on stage and be ready for peak performance, but at the same time be so calm and relaxed that they know what to do as far as their motor skills go?
I think it's both. I think they're really good at transitioning. So cognitively, being relaxed, you need to be relaxed, making sure you can think clearly. And then if you have to act, by all means, all out, do whatever it is you need to do. Okay, now I'm back down to being relaxed. I have to do this type of drill. I think of, like, the old videos of, like, the old Russian weightlifters, right? Huge dude wanders out on the stage. A dude looks like he's going to fall asleep.
Yeah.
The second he touches the bar, you're like, holy shit, watch this. Yeah, clean and jerk, world record. Wanders off stage like he's going to go take a nap.
Yeah, back to hibernation.
Right, back to hibernation he goes. In tundra somewhere or whatever.
Yeah.
But in the tundra. Yeah. But massive amount of parasympathetic till the absolute moment he needs to be as sympathetic as possible, and then back to being parasympathetic again.
Yeah.
Right. You see this in elite athletes a lot of times too. Right. Watch, like, NFL is great. Watch players in between plays. Watch, like, wide receivers and stuff. You'll see them kind of wander back to the line, but the second they're ready to go, they're gone.
Right.
Right. And the second the play is over, guys, you know, making fun of someone else or whatever, right?
Yeah.
They're completely on or then back to being off.
My roommate in college was the perfect example. He complete just freak athlete and out of Florida, fastest kid I've ever seen in my whole entire life. We played in junior college together, and then at the end of 2 years, he had offers to go anywhere he wanted to. Grades weren't there, so he didn't end up. That's the only reason I believe in why you haven't heard of him. Otherwise, his kid would be in NFL.
Yeah.
100%. And he was exactly the same way. We would practice, and then we would get a water break, and we would all jog over to the water cooler, and he would literally, right where he was, just lay down. And I'm not joking, take a nap for like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And then once practice resumed, he just popped up and started running again. There was actually one instance during spring where we were all just on the field, and we were just kind of like playing catch and playing around, and he was literally just laying in the end zone, dozing off, and the coaches just bought the new like laser time machine for like the 40-yard dash thing, and they were setting it up, and they were like, LV, come over here, come test this thing out, and he's like, oh, dude, I really don't want to, like, I'm relaxing, I'm just laying in the sun type of thing, and they're like, just, you don't have to go fast, just test it out. So he walks over, he takes off his sweatpants, takes off his hoodie, just in compression shorts, does like two stretches, jumps around a little bit, runs a 4.6. And we're like, oh my God, dude, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
And the rest of the day, like whenever there was in practice, he would just lay on the couch and just like move in turtle speed.
Yeah.
And we always said that that was his key to success. Like he would move so slowly for 98% of the day that like the 2% where he had to fire, he was just the fastest kid alive.
Yeah.
And I think that comes back to like being able to regulate up and down super fast.
Yeah, and it's very similar. Like if you work with, you know, special forces people or even just police, right? You think the average cop is probably sitting in a cop car. But if something ever went completely sideways, rare, but it happens, are you really going to get out of your car and go, hold on, got to stretch my hamstrings, got to make sure my hip flexors are good? It's like, no, you you have to go, you know, and a lot of times your life depends upon what happens at that point too. But so being able to train that too, even, you know, powerlifting or even CrossFit, right? So CrossFit, you got, you know, so you're competing three times in a day.
Sometimes more.
You don't see it as much now as what I used to see it, but if you went back like 5 years, I would watch like the games and I would go, that dude's not going to make it. That girl's not going to make it. And what you would see is they could not down-regulate between sets. You'd see them walk around. You'd see them stay amped up. And they would do really good. And then by the end of the competition, they were, like, nowhere to be found. I don't see that as much now, per se.
That's a really good point, actually, now that I think about it.
Now that people, I think, in CrossFit are getting more professional, too,
yes.
I think that's a big, big aspect of it, that their life revolves more around it, so the education factor comes in more, so they realize things like that are super important, that you're able to get the rest you need in between the hour and a half of the two events.
Yeah.
You need to like conserve as much energy as you possibly can before you need to go full speed again.
Yeah, and the old joke I used to make, although people still know who Rich Froning is, but not as much as a couple of years ago when he was competing, is like the joke I would make is like you would watch him compete, and every time I'm like, the dude's gonna lose. He's gonna lose. It doesn't look like he's trying that hard.
Yeah.
He's like at 70%. I'm like, oh my God. And he destroys everyone.
And then after that, he's usually just walking
around.
Hey,
man.
Totally fine. Yeah. And that was Matt Frazier last year, too. I mean, he won so many events, and I think they went into the last day, and he technically didn't even have to compete as far as points score. Like, he already won.
Crushed it.
And he had events where. I remember I forgot what exactly the event was, but it was a regionals event where at the very end they had all the ground over shoulder things with the sandbags, and then at the very end they had to like grab it and carry it over the finish line.
At regionals.
At regionals. And every single finish you saw, like, oh, here's another record, here's another record. You always saw these guys just like with the bag, and they literally like fell over the finish line and dropped, and they were just laying there. And then finally it was East Central, whatever Frazier is. And it was like, all right, Frazier beat the record again. And they showed a video. And this dude literally just jogs over the finish line, drops the bag, and, like, walks off the floor without, like, even breathing heavy. And
I was like, wow,
dude, this is fucking insane.
But just think on a psychological level, too, how demoralizing that would be to watch that as another competitor.
Absolutely.
I mean, to be, like, the dude who, like, did really hard and maybe you get second and you're destroyed, and you see some guy come in who just destroys your time and looks like...
Several times.
No big deal, man. Walk in the park. I'd be like, fuck.
That happens to me a lot. I've been to regionals. We have this guy, you know Josh Bridges?
Yeah. I know who he is, but...
Yeah, him and I would be in the same heat all the time, and he would do something where, like, I'm literally like, oh, I'm fucking cruising. And I look over, and I'm like, oh, this motherfucker's done? And I'd, like, I'd have to go back and watch the video online so I could see what he did. I'd be like, what did he do?
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense to me, but
that actually leads me just a little off path, but I wanted to ask this question. I have days where I'm working out and I go in and I warm up and I start the workout and I feel absolutely fantastic throughout the whole entire workout. I'm very clear in my mind. I feel very connected to the workout. I know what I'm doing the entire way through. I feel like I have my breathing under control. And by the time the workout ends, I knew I performed very well, but I'm okay. Maybe I'm laying on the ground. Maybe I need to breathe a little bit. But after 2 minutes, I'm up and I can go again. Then there's other days where there wasn't any significant difference in my outside life. So it wasn't like I went drinking the night before. It wasn't necessarily I'm super stressed out. It wasn't necessarily I didn't get any sleep. But there are days where I start working out and it just feels like I cannot get going. I'm breathing the entire time like my lung is going to come out of my throat. My heart rate is out of control. I feel like I'm zoning out in the middle of the workout. Like I'm not there physically. And then afterwards I go home and I'm done for the rest of the day. Where does that come from?
Oof. If I knew that, I'd
be
doing living on an island in Fiji somewhere probably. I think there's a lot more variability to one day and the next day than we currently understand, right? And I'm sure you guys have experienced this, right? So the scenario you just talked about, I'm sure you probably had that.
Multiple
where you
times.
Go to the gym and you're thinking in your head, you're like, yeah, I feel good. All my metrics are good. My nutrition's been on point. I slept good. Man, this is going to be the greatest training session ever. And you get there and you're like, this sucks.
Yeah,
why does
can't
this
get
suck?
Going.
Yeah, it happens all the time.
And in the past, I used to kind of force myself through it, and now I'm just like, I'll get to a point, and I'm just like, yeah, it's not, for whatever reason, it's not there, it's not there.
Yeah.
And then I'll just leave.
Wow, yeah.
You know, and but it's hard, too, because if somebody is new, maybe I want them to train through that. Maybe I want them to get the habit of doing things that are hard. But the risk you run is I think you increase your risk of injury, and I think you decrease your performance because you're literally training someone to be worse. Now, if you tell me you're trying to build the mental habit and things of that nature for someone who doesn't have the habit of exercise.
Just the resilience factor of it.
Yeah, maybe I can buy that. But if you're a higher level competitor and it's easy for you to go to the gym, it's hard for you not to go to the gym, I would argue that you're probably making your performance worse on those days. And just if it's not there, it's not there. I would probably leave at that point.
It's crazy to think that that takes so much experience. You know, I mean, it's two kinds of people I feel like that can do that. One is the person that just started working out. Right. They get to the gym and they're like, oh, I hate this. I'm going home.
Yep.
And then it's the other person who's been working out for 15, 20 years where they get 20, 25 minutes into their workout and immediately they're like, this just isn't it. This is just not my day. I'm going to go home. One of my favorite references or one of my favorite like stories I've ever heard was and this is back a guy that is training in Arizona with OPEX. And I know OPEX does a lot of testing. So like while their athletes are working out, they take blood samples. They have them like hooked up to the oxygen machine.
They run Moxie too.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So it's not just I feel like shit. It's actually like your metrics are off and you shouldn't be working out today. And then my buddy that I was talking to, he was doing like row repeats.
Yep.
And basically it was he had to keep it within 3 seconds of his first time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Not faster, not slower.
Yep.
Just keep it there. And he messed up once, went like 5 seconds slower, and they were like, all right, let's try this again. Took a little blood sample, did it again, went 5 seconds slower again. So they were like, all right, time, you're done.
Yep.
Time to go home. And he's like, what do you mean? Like, I just got here. Like, this is my training day, right?
Yeah.
So they're like, no, your metrics are off. You're not feeling great. And then this is my favorite coaching advice ever. He said to him, he goes, here's what you need to do. Go home, eat a cup of rice, jerk off, go to sleep. And then come back tomorrow, and I promise you, you're going to feel fucking fantastic. And, like, sometimes that's what it takes, you know, to just be able to quit mid-training and just call it a day.
Yeah, I like to have like some type of performance metric that you know you're not meeting.
Yeah.
And in a perfect world, then I'd be like, okay, you have a decision. So today, if you're following a eustress model, so stress that you can fairly easily recover from, you're matching your nutrition to your exercise modality and performance is your number one thing, then yes, you probably need to go home. The catch is, if you're going to have to perform on a set day, say for CrossFit to qualify or in the games or whatever, you have to decide now, am I going to make this a distress day, meaning that I'm going to run the risk of injury a little bit higher. I may have to take the next 2 or 3 days off, but I'm going to do it as a simulation practice because what if this happens on the day I do have to compete?
Absolutely.
That's a fair point.
Yeah, it's a great point.
But I think you have to decide that at that point and live with that decision.
Yeah.
Right? And I think if you have never done any distress training, that may be the perfect day to do it and be like, all right, I got to figure this shit out and I got to perform now. I'm not that worried about the cost. Obviously, I don't want to injure myself. Because if this happens on the day I have to compete, I need to know what it's like in practice. Or, like you said, if it's a eustress, then I would say, yeah, take the day off. You got plenty of time. Your competition's, say, 9 months out. You've done 2 distress sessions already in the past 3 cycles. You probably don't need any more distress training. You've done that before. You knew that if you had to do it right now, you'd probably be okay. But you don't need that simulation practice.
I love that. That's awesome.
You know what the reality of that probably is, though? Right?
Yeah.
You're going to have a shitty workout.
Yep.
You're going to be mad that you had a shitty workout. Mm-hmm. So you're going to come back later and work out again.
Well, first of all, you're going to leave the gym. You're going to not eat, right? You're not going to eat carbs or anything because, well, I didn't work out hard enough.
Uh-huh. Yep.
So I'm not going to eat.
So you're going to go back. You're going to work out harder. You're going to try to work out harder.
Yep.
And then you're supposed to have a rest day the next day, but you didn't really work out the day before.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
so
what happens.
Oh, yeah. And it's a whole mental game at that point, right? It's, you know, go home, do the exact same thing you did, But to your point, exactly, athletes are like, bro, I didn't earn my carbs.
Or I didn't even work out yesterday because I couldn't go hard.
Right. Yeah, and that's
a tough one. Oh. As a coach, as a gym owner for myself, that's really rough. Even for myself as an athlete,
sure,
I feel those days, and I'm like, I know that tomorrow needs to be a rest day because today was just a shit day. But just mentally, you know what I mean? It's just such a it's a hard compromise for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's get back on track.
Yeah.
Sorry about the little side note, but I think that was important. You mentioned RPR.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so it's originally from Doug Heal's work. He's out of South Africa, which was B-activated training. And that's the initial training that I did with it. And then he got a license to license it as RPR, so Reflexive Performance Reset, which is taught by primarily Cal Dietz, J.L. Holdsworth, Chris Corfus. And it's taking Doug's system and applying it to coaches and trainers. So Doug's kind of teaching more of the medical model to chiropractors, physicians, that type of thing. And then RPR is taught more to coaches and personal trainers.
Okay.
And it's a way of doing very simple strength tests to figure out what muscles are not working the way that they should be. And then to do a set of interventions just by pushing on tissue, right, different points that you work on, the athlete can work on themselves to get those muscles to then be activated again.
Okay.
And what I like about it is it's so I've taught it a couple times in Texas, actually, and once at Onnit. And the thing that amazed me about it was there's a lot of other, like, really cool systems out there, and I love a lot of the other systems. But, man, I don't even feel remotely qualified to do them on people, much less teach them. And to have people come in one day and leave and do something that's pretty effective, I think is a very good system. And the other part I would ask people, so we'd run them through, they'd be paired up. We'd say, okay, just for practice, you're going to work on each other, right, because it's just practice. And then we'll have you do the strength test on each other. You'll do the little point, and then you'll see, did the strength test improve? And at the end of running them through all these drills over the course of a day for level one, each time I'd be like, all right, everyone in the group, how many got better? You know, like 80% of the people would raise their hand. All right, how many got worse? I had one person once out of two full days that got worse that I was able to change in 30 seconds. And you would have some people that wouldn't change. But there wasn't much of a downside. So I think some systems can be really powerful, but if you do them wrong, the downside is very huge. You're really going to mess somebody up.
Mm-hmm.
Where with this, the odds of them messing up, as long as you're not being a complete dumbass, are pretty low. And the fact that these were most people's like first reps, and a lot of, 80, 90% of them were coaches. They've never really worked on another person. They've never done anything like this. That most of them were very effective after just 8 hours, it, to me, is like mind-blowing. And that's what like, is that it's effective and it's something that you can then teach also. And your athletes can do it on themselves. So you're handing a lot of that responsibility back to them. So once you get pretty good, okay, here's the little points you work on yourself. We'll either come in and do it as a group, or if it's one-off coaching, be like, hey, all right, your session starts at 9. Come in at 8:45. I want you to go through these points yourself. We'll start at 9. I talk to you and go, hey, anything not feeling good? You're like, yeah, my right psoas doesn't feel so good. All right, maybe I'll help you do a little more work there. Boom, you good to go? Yep, cool, let's go. So that's what I really like about it, that it's very fast but efficient. And it's not so complicated that the person and the athlete themselves can't figure out how to do it.
Gotcha. And if I'm a coach or an athlete, where do I go to learn this?
Yeah, just go to reflexiveperformancereset.com. They have all the different seminars and stuff like that. So.
Okay. And that helps with the down-regulating that we're talking about as well?
Yeah. So where I found it's really helpful is that a lot of the work they do is on breathing. So you can breathe like deeper and slower, and will that downregulate your parasympathetic? Absolutely. We know that from heart rate variability studies, and just anyone can run that test themselves at home. The next thing is, what if I could change your breathing mechanics so that it is better and easier for you to take more of a quote-unquote correct breath?
Cool. Okay.
Right? Could you use more of your diaphragm? Can you get more expansion in your ribs? Can you get a bigger, easier, and deeper breath? And with a lot of the RPR stuff, we do work like on the top of the pectoralis, middle of the sternum, below the ribs, kind of some visceral stuff or some points in there, and some of the stuff on the head for glute max. And what you're doing is you're making the system better and more able to breathe more efficient.
Wow, that's so really cool.
It's even amazing just how much we've talked about breathing recently.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, even like Cal's got a Cal Dietz, University of Minnesota, who I learned it from initially. He's got a lot of just amazing case studies where he took one. I think it was Kemmer. She was an Olympian of some form, and she had been doing kind of this standard, you know, moderate intensity bike work as just something they would use to monitor her progress. And so they had her heart rate, they had her work output and everything. And Cal went and did some of the RPR work on her. I want to say her heart rate during the same amount of work was like 10 or 11 beats less.
Wow.
The next day after they did it.
Wow. Just one session.
One session.
Wow. And that's an Olympic athlete who probably already has a low heart rate.
Yeah, and she was pretty low. And like her, I don't remember what her workload was, but it was like 140, 155. And they had standardized all the work rest ratios and everything. And she did the exact same output. You know, so they said, let's clamp the output and let's see where your heart rate, and it actually would drop.
That's really cool.
I mean, I've had people resting heart rate sometimes goes down 2, 3, 5, 8 points overnight, you know, just because their breathing is that much more efficient.
Yeah.
And so you think about competitors, right? You think about someone that's like CrossFit, probably pretty good aerobic engine, probably doing really good. The handful of people I've tested it on, the mechanics is usually a lot of times the weak link and the thing that they're missing. So they've done really, really good with their existing mechanics, but to kind of get to that next level, they kind of need to change some of their breathing mechanics to get there.
You can watch Rich Froning, like, in between.
Oh, yeah.
In between sets, he's like you can see him take, like, yeah, his chest, like, grow and then, like, breathe out. And he's, like, doing that in the middle. That's what makes him look like he's at 70%. If you can see someone breathing, it usually makes them look.
And breathing so slowly, too.
And
you know
methodically.
What I mean?
Like,
yeah, methodically. Like, exactly.
He breathes. Like, if you were to, like, sit there and count him to 100 thrusters, you could see him breathe at the exact same time every single time.
Yep.
Right.
And if you, there'd probably be a cadence, like a 1, 2, 3 count. Or
you can watch his first 10
count,
and you can watch his last 10, and they're going to be exactly the same.
And I've had several people break that down and count different things, and he's like exactly on point every single time with the exact same breath.
Yeah. And what I've seen in the videos of his breathing mechanics, they're really good.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he got lucky and he does it on purpose or what, but everything I've seen, his mechanics are very good.
And they say that he does work out an insane amount, like everybody says, but a lot of those sessions, we had another guy on who was saying that he kind of correlates those to, like, free throws on the basketball court.
Yeah.
They're not very necessarily super hard sessions, but he might be working on something like breathing and just, like, technique and stuff like
and
that.
And moving better.
Yeah.
And I would say he runs, from what I've seen, the ultimate eustress model, right? He pushes volume, but from what I've seen, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong, you don't see him in practice do a lot of super hard distress sessions.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. We call him the free throw stress.
Yeah, exactly.
He does exactly what you say. He does it every now and then just to prove to himself,
definitely,
I can still do it if I have to. But other than that, he never goes through that stress.
Yeah.
And it's so crazy to me how much, like Fish said, we talk about breathing so much lately in all the podcasts. And I think it's become such a big topic, too. And just the difference that it makes in and outside the gym,
yes,
to be in control of your breath and like be connected to it is just absolutely incredible. I mean, you feel more connected to your workouts. I feel like you know what's going on instead of just being a zombie and just kind of floating through your workout. You're more methodical. You're moving better. I've been trying to. I forgot where I heard this, but I've been trying to implement this technique where CrossFit, a big thing is always transition times, right? So, like, the open just ended, and people are always talking about, like, okay, well, I'm going to be 20 seconds of this movement, 30 seconds of this movement, 15 seconds of this movement, and in between my transitions, I'm going to try and not go over 15 seconds. Now, something that I found really cool, a different approach to that is, instead of just going off of time, they go off of the breathing pattern. So, like, I'm going to breathe 3 times or 4 times and then go back to the next exercise. What I think is really cool about that is, one, it kind of makes you aware of your breath. And then, two, you automatically slow your breath down because you want those 4 breaths to last as long as you possibly can before you have to go back to work.
Yeah, no, I love that kind of stuff. Like, so it's a biofeedback kind of model. Cal Dietz has one similar that he calls a biometric method, where you'll do, like, a squat. You'll put a heart rate strap on. You'll have your heart rate display. No, who cares what your max is during the squat? Doesn't matter. Let's say you're doing old school Bill Starr 5x5, right? So you do 5 reps, you end at 155. But now your next set doesn't start until your resting heart rate gets to 100 or 90 or 70. And then now you go again. And then you see how long it takes you to complete that work, right? Because it's training. You're not necessarily – you don't have to do a density in a specific time. It's open-ended.
Yep.
And then over time, you could even do the same amount of work and just compress that density, but you're doing it by getting the positive adaptation of, one, the skill set, like you were saying, of how do I get my heart rate down, and then, two, a little bit of a conditioning effect, but you're not sacrificing the quality of the work that's being done. And then the second part of that is I'll even push the heart rate lower if I want purely skill development. Mm-hmm. Right, so look at the classic way Olympic weightlifters train. Super high level of skill, very long rest periods.
Right.
Now, some would argue that that's because of the recovery of the fast and slow ATP, CP, and all that stuff. Yeah, I think that's part of it. But I think part of it is because it's so skill development that you have to get really down to these low levels again, I think, especially when learning to be able to execute those skills again.
Yeah, and it's such high output as well.
Yes, exactly, 100%.
Yeah.
To get back to the, we're almost out of time, but just to those skill techniques to kind of work on your down regulation, besides RPR, what are some other things that you've
So there's a whole bunch of them. Like, I find, and it's crazy, I got this from Dr. Ben House in Functional Med Costa Rica, literally have clients program 1 hour of something by themselves that they enjoy. And it's crazy how I've had clients do that, and it's been beneficial. Maybe not so much because it's the hour they got to work on themselves, but the fact that they gave themselves permission to do it.
Yeah, and so it's scheduled.
And scheduled. So right. I'll email them and like, hey, I want you to do something that's only for yourself, by yourself. No, it's not watching TV. Like, read a book, go for a walk. I don't care. Go hang out in a float tank, get a massage, whatever. Something that's more relaxing. Tell me what you're going to do and tell me the time and then tell me how it went. And they're like, this is crazy. I'm doing this for fat loss. And but I know their life is very stressful. They usually don't allow themselves to give themselves permission to do that, to put themselves as a priority, even for an hour a week.
Right.
And once they're able to do that, I had a client just last week who's like, yeah, I went and I read for an hour by myself. I just had some light music on. She's like, it was great. I'm going to do it again next week. She's like all excited. You know, and it wasn't that she didn't necessarily have the time. It wasn't a high enough priority.
Mm-hmm.
So stuff like that, even going outside, you know, looking at going for a walk in the woods, right? You can look at the Japanese research on forest bathing. That's extremely beneficial. Maybe looking at because of the fractal patterns of the trees or whatever.
Okay.
I know forest bathing?
Forest bathing, which I was on Barbell Shrugged. I joked, I'm like, so is that like running into the woods, a bunch of hippies like hitting themselves with twigs and sticks and stuff?
Yeah, 100%.
And that's what I thought it was at first.
Yeah.
I thought some dude just made up the term, and I looked it up, and I was like, holy shit, there's actually some pretty good research on it. it was interesting. When I was in Costa Rica at Ben House's place, I was down there for 2 weeks. It was amazing. And one client there, I would see her off whenever she would get nervous. She would go off to the side and just stare out at the jungle. And I found like, oh, my God, I'm doing like the same thing. Right, it's like if you look at the ocean. I was in Sao Padre recently, so I would do like a Zen style meditation in the morning where I would just stare at the water.
I was just talking to Fish about this today. The blue mind theory. I don't know if you've heard of that, but that's basically exactly what you're saying. That when we're around large bodies of water, that our brain basically gets overwhelmed because we can't comprehend the power and the mass of the water.
Oh, sure.
So it just calms you down and just takes away anxiety because all of a sudden you seem smaller.
Oh, interesting.
Right? So that's exactly the same thing. I feel the same way. Like, we live in Newport Beach, so
the
ocean is right there.
Yeah.
You can't be stressed out staring out at the ocean. It's just
impossible.
It's
very hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I love doing that. Obviously, there's all different forms of meditation, which is super helpful. A little bit harder sometimes to get clients to apply it, like long walks, just being relaxed, taking your dog for a walk. I mean, there's research on
can be a form of meditation almost.
Oh, yeah, moving meditation.
Right.
There's different ways you can do that. We did some of that in Costa Rica, which was very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Just literally go for a walk and don't have any headset in, don't have any noise, and just breathe and pay attention.
Yeah, just chill the fuck out for once.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like a huge fan of float tanks. Right?
Yeah.
So go in a float
tank. We've been
talking
about that too. Yeah.
We wanted to do an episode on that, but we have to go do it first.
Oh, dude. Like, go to Zero Gravity here in Austin.
Oh, they have it here.
Oh, it's amazing.
Might
like,
just do that.
The tank's super nice. I think it was Kevin Johnson that designed them. I could be wrong on that.
Okay.
But I've been there a couple times. Nothing to disclose. But yeah, great place. Super right. nice. But yeah, just I did one in Venice for 2 hours. That
two
was
hours. Wow.
A little weird. Cause
that's a long time.
The guy who owns it is like one of the original guys who developed a lot of the float tanks and did one for Joe Rogan and maintains his tanks and all this stuff. And so I'm all excited to go to his place, and it's right on Venice. And the tanks are like super nice, super amazing, like 2 hours. It was very cheap. But at the end, it's so funny. It's like brilliant in one area, and then at the end, all you hear is this, get up!
Yeah.
like, he yells at you at the end and when your session is up.
That's like the same thing when you're just leaving vacation. You've been on vacation for like a week, 10 days, and then on the way back, your flight gets delayed and your car breaks down, and then everything is just fucking dead. It was all for nothing.
Yeah, but very cool experience. If people have the chance to do that, I'd recommend it. So
that's
just
awesome.
Yeah.
We got to do that for sure.
Yeah, yeah, I would highly recommend it. I mean, the first time I did it, I was like scared to death. And I'm like, well, what am I afraid of? I'm not going to drown in here. I can open the door and get out. And then I realized I'm like, oh, I'd be in here for an hour or 90 minutes, like with my own thoughts and nothing else.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm like, oh, that's scary. Yeah.
Right, well, yeah, we have to give that a try.
Definitely.
We'll
try that. Maybe even while we're here. Do you have anything else to add, Ryan?
I don't right now. Is there anything, is there anywhere that people can find you and a lot of the stuff that you're doing and the research that you're doing?
Yeah, yeah. They can just go to miketnelson.com. So miketnelson.com. And I'll have at the top a little opt-in for the newsletter. That's probably where 90% of my information goes out is through the newsletter. And then got a bunch of articles, calendar, a bunch of other stuff on there. And, yeah, it's probably the best place.
Cool. miketnelson.com.
All right, awesome. Fish, what you got going on?
You guys know me, the programming mastermind. Got the worldwide mobile app. Got about 1,000 people on there right now that follow the online workouts, helping gym owners every day. I hope you guys want to give it a go one time. I will personally send you a promo code for a free month if you like. Just email me, ryan@crossfitchalk.com. And then all of our design work that you guys see and you love so much is from your boy Yaya over here.
Yep, all the stuff you're going to see from this weekend too, all the videos, photos, podcasts, all that stuff, all coming from me. So if you guys see anything in that area, yaya@crossfitchalk.com. Find me at Yaya's View on Instagram, got at Ryan Fish on Instagram, or at CrossFit Chalk. Shoot your questions our way. I had a lot of fun. Mike, thank you so much. My brain definitely.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it, guys. This was a good time. Fun stuff.
I love talking about stuff that I love.
I know. My brain definitely grew again, so that's good. All right, cool. Thank you, Mike.
Cool. Thanks.
And that will wrap it up. I hope you guys' brains aren't bleeding too bad from being fucking blown away right now. I know there was a lot of information, so if you guys want to go back and listen to it two more times, three more times, four more times, it's not going to go anywhere. It's going to stay here. But while you do that, make sure you guys please, please subscribe to the Shrug Collective. Leave us a review. Tell everybody that Real Chalk is your favorite show in the collective so we have some bragging rights next time we go out with all these guys. Thanks for tuning in, guys. As always, I just wanted to remind you guys about the giveaway that we have going on at Chalk right now with the Chalk Online Programming. If you guys sign up for the Chalk Online Program before June 1st, you guys are automatically going to be entered into a raffle, not only to win your very own brand new ski irk, but be outfitted with an entire home gym. For more information on that, head over to either at Ryan Fish on Instagram or just at CrossFit Chalk on Instagram. Or to sign up, go to crossfitchalk.com, find the online button, sign up for $20. $20 before June 1st, you guys are going to be entered into this raffle, and you're going to get so jacked just in time for summer, breaking necks, snapping checks, all that whatever stuff. Yeah, you guys feel me. Alrighty. Have a great day. Stay jacked, y'all.